Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. All across America, they are springing up, especially along the Sun Belt. You're talking about child-free communities. They don't necessarily bill themselves as that. But they are age-restricted communities where the residents don't want children. They don't want to pay for schools. They don't want playgrounds. And they don't want strollers going down the street. We're going to be talking about it today, about what that says about us. Who would want to live in such a place? Well, probably some people even listening to this program. I'd like for us to talk about what that means and as a society, what it means for us to allow through legislation and other policies the development of these communities and what it would mean to live in them. This is a profound statement, I think, about the revolutionary cultural changes that center in family and children. No better topic for us to discuss today than child-free communities, and no better place to discuss it than right here on the Albert Mohler Program. Call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, a review of some issues in the news. The LA Times and other media sources are out with the reminder that the U.S. population is soon to eclipse 300 million. That is a significant milestone. Back in 1915, the population was 100 million. And about 1967, it was 200 million, and now very quickly it's going to be 300 million. Interestingly, demographers are out trying to make their prognostications about who this 300th new American will be and when he or she will come and where. Peter Francese of USA Today is suggesting that the 300 millionth American will be a baby boy born of a white non-Hispanic woman living in the South, who is likely to be 28 or 29 years old, and he estimates that the D-Day for the birth of the 300 millionth American will be October 27. Well, we'll see. That will be very interesting to watch. But it does tell us something about how America is changing, because it's not just the numbers, the raw numbers of Americans, it's also the demographic. It is also the fact that in a state like California, there is no dominant racial segment. There is no dominant ethnic group. And all across America, racial and ethnic diversity are becoming the norm rather than the exception. And it's not only by birth, of course, that America's population is growing, but also by immigration, both legal and illegal. And because demography is a big part of our future, whether or not you believe that demography is destiny, at least we must all concede that the raw numbers here do tell us something about the contours of our society. A nation of 300 million persons is in many ways a different nation than one of 100 million persons. And we will be learning together just what all those changes may mean. Interesting anniversaries this year. Just in the last week, we faced the anniversary of the IBM PC. I wrote about it today at my weblog at albertmohler.com because it's one of those reminders to us of the importance of technology in our lives. And it's also a reminder that we live in a time in which many persons simply do not remember or frankly do not know of the pre-PC era. Bill Gates of Microsoft refers to what he calls Generation E. Generation E are those born after 1985 or so, and they never know a time without the personal computer, without digital information and entertainment. They don't know a time before the microprocessor and the microchip. And thus, reality as they know it is all after that was developed. Now, I'm old enough, I can remember before that. As a matter of fact, I can remember doing most of my work in higher education as a student before we had computers. But I was in that transitional era. I ended up writing my dissertation on an IBM PC and for my doctoral work. So somewhere between, say, 1980 and 1990, there was a huge shift, and it was indeed on August the 12th of 1986 that IBM released its machine known as the 5150, the first IBM computer known as the personal computer. Now, what's really interesting when you look at it is how slow and how inefficient and low-powered this machine really was. As a matter of fact, it only had a 4.77 megahertz processor, which is 650 times slower than today's PCs. It had up to, now it didn't come with a standard, you could by accessorizing get up to 256 kilobytes of memory, which is 8,000 times less than the average PC today. And you could buy an optional floppy drive with 160 kilobytes of capacity, which was barely enough for a small to medium-sized word processing document. You know, if you put one of these machines in front of the average 15- or 16-year-old today, they would look at you as if you had just pulled up Fred Flintstone's car and, you know, just invented the wheel. This is absolutely beyond their comprehension. We're living in a day in which not only does the average handheld cell phone out-operate the IBM PC 5150 from 1986, but our economy would simply come to a standstill if we had to return not only to the pre-computer era, but even to the 1986 computer era. But what's the big deal here? The big deal is that this technology has now, in the most incredible way, the most pervasive and sometimes even invisible way, entered our lives and changed the way we live. If you are a student, if you're a politician, if you're a communicator, if you're a mathematician, a scientist, if you're just about anybody, you consider the computer to be a basic part of the equipment of your life. As a matter of fact, there are human rights groups that are claiming that access to both a computer and the World Wide Web is now to be considered a basic human right. Now, just consider that. You're talking about a basic human right by their definition? A basic human right to a technology that did not even exist just a little over 25 years ago. You know, the meaning of technology in our lives is a big issue because most of us simply don't think about it. We use it. We enjoy it. We are entertained by it. We communicate by it. I mean, just consider the email revolution in communications. You can now talk to just about anyone, communicate with just about anyone anywhere in the world in almost real time. And not only that, it's not going through any post office. It's not being delivered into a mailbox. It's being delivered right from PC to PC. Just think of the political revolution that's involved here. You know, autocratic regimes can shut down in many ways what comes through in terms of hard material, that is to say, actual non-digital information. They can stop newspapers. They can destroy printing presses. They can intercept things mailed. But you really can't stop the Internet. You can't stop the computing revolution. And for that reason, it has become a mechanism for toppling regimes. But on the other hand, it's also become a mechanism for regimes presenting themselves, even the most autocratic. For instance, AlJazeera.net is reporting today that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has started a blog. That's right. I will point out that he started it about 3 years after I started mine, but welcome to the club. And so what we have here is the Iranian leader who somehow thinks it is to his advantage and the advantage of his nation to blog. The blog is translated into English, French, and Arabic, and it is, well, as some folks might say, a hoot. It is distressingly hilarious to read the Iranian president as he is blogging. It's pretty interesting stuff, but of course we're talking about a real live threat to world order. We're going to be talking a little bit about that this week as some very interesting events are coming together in the Middle East. But at this point, let's just note that the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, thinks that blogging is the future. It's kind of a if you can't beat them, join them thing for the Iranian leader. And it's a reminder to us again that 25 years after the release of the IBM PC, it's now a part of almost everyone's life. Now, by the way, one last note. I was looking at an article just this past week, looking at the quarter century anniversary. And you know what is happening right now? People who said that they would never touch a computer, that they would never learn the computer, that they didn't want anything to do with the computer, are becoming masters of the computer. That's right. You know where one of the biggest segments of growth is right now in terms of the growth of web pages, even in places like MySpace? Senior adults. That's right. It is the growth trend right now where an awful lot of senior adults are beginning to communicate by email and on web pages and even MySpace. That in itself is interesting. Speaking of interesting, it's interesting to see some scientists finally coming out and being honest about the promise of stem cell research. We have been told in this highly politicized debate, week after week and for the past several years, that if we would just put more money into the federal subsidy of human embryonic stem cell research, and if we would just remove all these ethical constraints, that there would be therapies to solve diseases and problems like paralysis and spinal cord injuries and diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and all the rest. And don't we long for cures for those illnesses? Of course we do. We've been promised that those therapies were right around the corner. Now the New York Times is reporting in today's paper that many researchers now see human embryonic stem cell research as part of a very long-term program, with any sort of cell therapy being at least a decade or so off. That honesty in itself will help. We'll be right back to talk about child-free communities coast to coast. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. They are popping up all over the country, child-free communities. They're really age-restricted or age-qualified communities. Christopher Caldwell, in Sunday's edition of the New York Times Magazine, really looks at this in a very fascinating way, suggesting that it is a major change, a social trend, that will mark our country for some time to come. It also says a lot about what we talk about on this program, the breakdown of community, and the fault lines of America on the issue of family. Now, a lot of these are in the Sun Belt, which is understandable. Mr. Caldwell begins his report in Kissimmee, Florida, where there is one of these newly built housing units, 242 acres, that says, that, as the administrator boasts, the beauty of that is no impact on schools. There are no kids. There are no families with children. None of these homes can be inhabited or purchased by families with children. Let me just read to you from Mr. Caldwell's report. He says, the mighty fortress of anti-discrimination law and custom has an exception when it comes to satisfying the wishes of older people, and builders, residents, and local governments are exploiting it. Gated communities, condo complexes, and plain old suburban neighborhoods can, provided they meet certain criteria, legally bar children under 18 as residents, or even in some cases as visitors. According to Big Builder magazine, such communities are the hottest trend in the residential housing market. There are already thousands of age-qualified, quote, lifestyle communities, end quote, and their growth is accelerating. Now, I grew up in South Florida. I have observed this for most of my lifetime. I've seen it in other parts of the country. You could go all the way from Southern California, all across the Sun Belt to Florida. You could go to other regions, even far beyond the Sun Belt, in northern states where similar communities are being established, because there are some persons who think they have reached the point where they just don't want to be around families with children. They don't want the basketball goal out front. They don't want to see bikes in the driveway. They don't want to hear the pitter-patter of little feet. You know, they don't want playgrounds, and they don't want schools. You know, no school buses have to come in these age-qualified communities. You don't have to worry about having the signs on the road, you know, slow, children at play. In some of them, as Mr. Caldwell makes clear, it's not just that families with children cannot buy and live there. It is even that those under 18 can be prevented even from visiting, which would seem to make it a little difficult to keep the grandchild-grandparent relationship going there, but maybe we'll learn about some of that in the program today. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. You know, on this program, we try to talk intelligently, calmly, respectfully about issues that very well could be of some controversy. Now, I'm not sure about whether or not there should be a right to such communities. That would be a debate for a different program. I am not an attorney discussing the legalities of these communities. I am with you seeking to understand what this means for our country. And furthermore, I want to know what it means for individuals. I would really like to know who would like to live here and what this says about their understanding of family and community. I mean, after all, we're talking about age-qualified communities, and the exception is only at the upper end. I mean, there is no community that can discriminate on the other way. In other words, no community can say, if you're 55 or 65 or older, you can't live here. There would seem to be some basic issue at stake here that must go deeply into the national psyche, and I think is pointing in the future towards the age segregation of American culture in ways that I see as very, very dangerous. I think the organic community, which is based upon honoring the natural family and its extended unit and the building of community for the common weal, there was a news story that we talked about just a couple of weeks ago from the Wall Street Journal, in which an observer was noting that people don't try to correct other people's kids, even when they're doing something dangerous, because we have this breakdown of community in which we understand that we're all a part of a community, we're all a part of having an interest in the raising of children, the educating of children, and the turning of children into productive citizens. Something is broken in that vision, and I think that's at least a part of what's behind these child-free, age-qualified communities. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky, where Gil's on the line listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Gil.
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Mueller. I guess my main point is that these child-free communities are probably going to have to be church-free communities, aren't they?
Well, I was hoping someone would get us there, Gil, because as a Christian theologian, I have to say I think that may be my first concern. Where is the intergenerational understanding of the church? I guess you can't have a church unless it's just going to be an age-defined church. What do you think this says about us, Gil?
Well, I think what it is that the that outside the church, it's unchristian children who make us not want to be around them, I guess. I guess that's sort of what I'm getting at.
Well, children, even at their very best, are messy and loud and noisy. They are needy little people. And then they only turn into needier little, not quite so small people as teenagers. One of the fascinating things of all this to me is how that you have this complete generational breakdown. We were looking at last week at a woman who said that it was beneath the dignity of women in general to even change a diaper or something like that. And we pointed out, well, someone had to change her diaper or she wouldn't be here to write that article. Well, someone has to support the raising of children, and someone has to honor that, and some community really has to honor that for this to take place. Thanks for your call, Gil. Let's go to Steve calling from Saskatchewan in Canada, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Steve.
Hello, Dr. Mueller. It's a pleasure to speak to you. I discovered you on the radio just a few months ago. I just wanted to
Thank
make
you.
A comment about seniors. I recently went to a senior's home to visit an aunt of ours. And the seniors, as we all know, sitting around the lobby of a senior's residence are quite lost and quite lonely. And they're just kind of desperate for someone to visit them and talk to them. And I just thought to have a child come into that situation would be just a wonderful thing. And when I hear about adult communities sort of banning children because of the inconvenience or the, quote, messiness of them, it's just a sad thing. And you talked about loss of church. I think it's called loss of life because children bring life, whatever age they are, and we can delight in children and be better people because of their influence on us.
I have actually a hard time not delighting in children. Now, there are non-delightful moments, even with your own. And that's true for all of us when we were kids as well. We created some non-delightful moments. But in reality, it is sheer delight to have children. It is delight to have their energy. It is delight to have just about everything that they are. And I can't imagine a community that would just willfully do this. I can't imagine it. I've seen them. I've been in them. But I can't imagine that this could be a totally satisfying experience. I'm also going to say something else here, and this may prompt someone to call and take me on. And if so, the number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. But I think the isolation of a lot of senior adults is a scandal. But when they isolate themselves, I just can't imagine how this makes it anything but worse. When you even say, if you're 18 or under, you not only can't live here, but in some of these communities, you can't even visit. What kind of loneliness is that? The phone number, 877-893-8255. We're talking about age-qualified communities. And what that means is child-free. As my associate and colleague Russ Moore says, we could call it kinderphobia. We'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Obviously, we have struck a nerve talking about child-free communities. Now, that's not what they usually call them. They are, to use the legal parlance, age-qualified communities. By the way, Christopher Caldwell, in his New York Times Magazine article looking at this, talks about some of the euphemisms that come up, some of the ways these things are discussed. And, you know, they talk about, quote, active adult communities, which means no kids. One fairly typical homeowner identified in the article said, I love children, but when you get to be a certain age, you want to be in a community where people around you are the same age as you are. I guess that gets to the point to me. And in other words, do I want to live in a community where people are the same age that I am? I don't think so. I want to know what's going on here. Let's go to Ethel, listening on WTBN in Tampa, Florida. She's in Sarasota. Go ahead, Ethel.
Hey, how you doing this afternoon? I'd just like to say I love children, too. I have four ranging from 28 to 18. And when I was younger, I was thinking, you know, I would never want to segregate myself out from a diversity of ages. But since I've gotten older, I've come to realize that it doesn't seem like there's a respect for older people. I helped a young child, very young child, running after his mother out into a parking lot, and I set the child down very gently and very nicely. And the child was crying and calmed him down, and the mother was angry at me. And, you know, I couldn't figure out if she wanted to accuse me of child abuse because I was trying to keep her child from running into a busy parking lot. And I just couldn't figure that one out, and any people around me couldn't figure that out. And also in my own community where we do have a range of ages, I would love to start a, you know, like a mother's morning out or something, but it doesn't seem like anybody wants that Titus II type of woman anymore who gives direction to younger women. And even in church situations, you find that, you know, older women, their ideas or whatever they want to give, it's just, the respect just isn't there. And that's what I'm finding to be the biggest issue now that I am approaching that age group.
Well, Ethel, I appreciate your call, and you put something very important on the table for our discussion here. But I'm going to come back again and again to where I have to land, and that is with the local church. The intergenerational vision of the local church is absolutely essential. And where there is that Titus II ministry neglected by a local church, it is to its own shame, and it is to its own weakening. And so that I think that's where we need to direct a lot of our attention. You know, where in the local church are we showing this intergenerational unity and transfer and commonality and community and intergenerational respect? And where we don't see it, this is a scandal for the church long before we get to the community. Let's go to Jay, listening on WPIT. We want to welcome in Pittsburgh, our new affiliate, WPIT. Jay, go right ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious, you know, I've been listening, and I'm 38 years old. Me and my wife have a six-figure income, and I'll be honest with you, if I could move into a child-free community like you're speaking of, I would. Our community right now, currently, there's hundreds of kids in the communities, and like your last caller, it seems like there's the parents of the children nowadays, I mean, regardless whether teenagers or small kids, don't appreciate your interaction with their children. And it seems like the children pick up on that, and they feel like they can do whatever they do whenever they want to do it. So, you know, I'm hearing that you talk about it being almost a religious type of – there's going to be some kind of backlash here because of the extended community and that kind of thing. And I'm seeing more and more today parents don't want outsiders to be part of their extended family.
Yeah, well, Jay, you also raised something. I have to tell you, I'm a little bit surprised, and that's why this kind of conversation is important. I'm a little bit surprised by how this conversation has, at least with the last two callers, kind of transformed into the fact that the real problem in the view of at least some, if I'm understanding the callers, is parents of children not parenting or disciplining their children and not understanding the need for a larger community in which people who aren't parents and others are there as well. That's interesting. I just have to see the solution to this as being something other than withdrawal into age-segregated communities. And again, when we're talking about age-segregated communities, this doesn't go both ways. We're only talking about communities where older people are saying, we don't want any children. Can you imagine the constitutional crisis and the lawsuits that would emerge if we had communities in which you said no one over age 65 could live there? Very interesting point, I think. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. By the way, I have the advertisement for one of these communities here. I won't mention exactly what it is, but I'll just tell you the way they advertise themselves is very, very clear. An age-segregated community. It says this is an age-restricted community. If you're not 55 years old, you'll wish you were here without the kids. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Obviously, this is a controversial issue. We're talking about these age-qualified communities, more commonly discussed in the larger culture as child-free communities. In 1995, after federal courts blocked some of these housing units, Congress stepped in to clarify the criteria for keeping a residential complex child-free. I'm reading here from Christopher Caldwell in the New York Times. It waived the requirement for significant facilities, et cetera, et cetera. But it says that 80% of households must have a person 55 or older, and the development must be billed as a senior community or retirement community or some straightforward phrase. Mr. Caldwell goes on and says this last requirement's almost always universally flouted. Developers prefer to say adult, active adult community. So here's the interesting thing. According to this, 80% of households must have a person 55 or older, but this means they can say there can be no one 18 or younger. So what's interesting is that in a lot of these age-qualified, if we're going to use that euphemism, communities, you could be in your 20s or 30s and live there so long as 80% of the households in this qualified community have someone 55 or older, but you can't be 18 or younger. The more I look at this, frankly, the more frustrated I get. And the more troubled I become. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Catherine, calling from Clearwater, Florida, listening on WTBN. Go ahead, Catherine.
Yes, I'm 52 years old, and I'm totally against having these age restrictions. My husband and I have had a very difficult time even finding a place to live that isn't 55-plus that's a reasonable price. And plus, I'm a social worker, and I had a... grandparents who had to make a decision as to whether or not they would take custody of their granddaughter when their daughter had run into some problems. And so they had to decide whether they were going to take custody of their daughter or move to another location.
You know, we all needed to hear that, Catherine. We all needed to hear that real-life experience because that really points to it. In other words, here you have grandparents who had to choose between being grandparents and living in the community, being grandparents who would take custodial responsibility at least for some time of grandchildren, and that is a very common experience in this culture and in this country, and then living in the community. Catherine, thank you for that call. Let's go to Dan, calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Dan.
Yes, Dr. Moeller. I'd just like to say that in this day when we hear so much about abortion and assisted suicide, there's a very large potential for backfire here. We're teaching young people not to value and respect life, and these older folks that are secluding themselves may find that these young people that they've taught this lack for value of life aren't going to want to care for them when they get older and need younger people to take care of them.
Well, they're not even going to be able to have a younger person care for them. In some of these communities, if they don't even allow 18 and under to visit, you're exactly right. Dan, what we're talking about here is the breaking of a chain of intergenerational respect and obligation. And I think theologically that's the big point here, the breaking of a chain of intergenerational respect and obligation. And where you break it, you just have these huge gaps that instantly emerge, including the one you're talking about. Who's going to take care of these folks when they find themselves isolated by age? Let's go to Steve, calling from Murphy, North Carolina, listening on XM. Go ahead, Steve.
Hello, Dr. Muller. How are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you.
Good. I'd like to just make a little statement. You know, we actually, this kind of started a long time ago. You know, we started in churches with youth groups and then young men groups, young women groups, senior groups, and we need our seniors. We need the wisdom they have. I don't know about every church being like that, but I know a lot of them are. They separate them. And we need the wisdom. We need it for our youth.
Carry it along. Yeah, Steve, that's true. You know, it's a difficult issue to set down structurally in a perfect way. But let me put it this way. I think it is entirely appropriate for a church to have a youth ministry. But not if that means that the youth are completely segregated out from the congregation. And I'll tell you, the key issue to me is the development of what's called children's church or youth worship. That's where I would draw the line. I think specified, very specialized ministries to youth, senior adults, men, women, all the rest, I think that's all very important. But when the church gathers for worship, we should gather together. And we should gather together regardless of generation and age and all the rest. And I think that's very important. You know, my father is, he'd be qualified as a senior adult, soon to turn 70 years old, and he works in the youth ministry of the local church in Pompano Beach, Florida. That says something right there. I mean, there's some intergenerational contact and respect and obligation that you don't see everywhere. And, you know, hats off to my dad for that. And, you know, what if more grandfathers got involved in the youth ministry? Grandmothers, too. But I'll tell you what, if there were more grandfathers and grandmothers involved in youth ministry, you'd probably have a very different view of youth ministry and an awful lot of young people who might not have otherwise any positive engagement with adults of that age would have it through the local church. And I think God's glory is in that. We're talking about these child-free, age-qualified communities that are springing up all over the country. And that really is a fascinating development. I'm interested that the New York Times finds it interesting. And it's apparent from the way Christopher Caldwell wrote his article in the New York Times that he has at least one eye on the legalities here. In other words, you know, Congress has already tampered with this. The courts have been involved in this. To some extent, this is going to become a much larger issue when you consider that a lot of folks are now pulling themselves into these communities, age-qualified communities, and that makes it all the more difficult for communities to raise funds for schools, parks, and all the rest that go with kids. And from coast to coast, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, north to south, this is becoming more of a reality, although at least at present, these age-qualified communities are concentrated largely in the Sun Belt, all the way from California to Florida, where we see these different communities springing up. Folks, we've had an interesting conversation just trying to think about this as we've been talking about what's going on in these age-qualified communities. But, you know, when you start talking about what it's like to imagine true community, we better look first to the church. And in the church, we had better look for that intergenerational respect and obligation and dependency that is modeled in Scripture itself. In Scripture, there is very clearly an emphatic insistence upon the responsibility of elders to take care of the young. And along with that, there is a very clear responsibility of the young to respect the elders. And if you break that intergenerational dependency and you break that really, genuinely, organically true community, then you end up with a breakdown, not only in individual relationships, but in the very idea of community itself. I'll be right back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back. That was an interesting conversation about the breakdown of community having to do with these planned communities that are age-qualified or child-free. It was an interesting conversation prompted by an article in the New York Times, and it's clear from the callers who called into this program that there are those who would want to live in such a community. I see that as a sad thing, and I see that as a sign of trouble for our national future. As retreat into age-qualified communities can't be a good thing for sustaining the level of community necessary for this to be a healthy society. We also began at the top of this hour talking about the 25th anniversary of the IBM PC. While we're talking about community, maybe it's important to recognize another anniversary, and I'm going to be writing about that later in coming days and weeks. This is the 100th anniversary of the development of air conditioning. In 1906, Mr. Carrier, that's Willis Carrier, known as the father of air conditioning, got his patent for, quote, a method of heating and humidifying air. The word air conditioning was first used also in that same year, 1906, by Stuart Kramer, textile engineer from Charlotte, North Carolina, when he himself applied for a patent. Air conditioning took a while to take hold, but it has revolutionized our culture, and that also impacts community, because air conditioning made inside air-conditioned space the place where the people are. And so community has also been weakened by the fact that people are not outside sitting on the front porch. They're not engaged in their communities the way they once were, as air conditioning became a further way of Americans cocooning themselves inside. Now, I have to tell you that on a day of heat, I'm thankful for air conditioning. And so are the rest of Americans, because at present, 87% of American single-family homes are air-conditioned, along with the vast majority of offices and all the rest. In fact, we now think of air conditioning as not only a human right, for, you know, but almost a health necessity in times of genuine heat. But it is also a reminder to us that over the last several years, decades indeed, we have changed the way we live in so many different ways. We've changed the way we educate, the way we work, the way we communicate, the way we transport ourselves, the way we are entertained, and all of this together has added up to a deficit of community. People aren't sitting on the front porch, cooling themselves in the evening, engaged in conversation with their neighbors. They're not watching their neighbors' children grow up and feeling like they're part of the same community. They're not living with senior adults and teenagers and infants and toddlers all in the same community, watching each other and watching out for each other. But folks, it's one thing for that to break down out there in the secular world. It's another thing for that to break down in the church. Here, at least, among the fellowship of the redeemed, those who are in Christ, there must be a recovery of what it means to be a true community. If it doesn't start in the church, where in the world do we think it's going to start? It is a testimony of the church to the glory and the mercy of God. I'll meet you tomorrow. This is Albert Moeller.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.